The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Camilla Ruse. On the show this week...
But I also got something which is called a tropical net, which is 5 meters, 5 meters high. So that prevents me to go and climb the trees.
Blanca Huertas there, the Indiana Jones of butterfly collectors, will be telling us about Sensational Butterflies exhibition at London's Natural History Museum, where you can see these majestic insects in full flight. And...
In terms of biomass, I mean, if you were to add up all the ants in the world, they would equal the biomass of all the humans in the world.
As BBC's Alien Nation season of documentaries on the planet's insects is underway, I meet George McGavin to discuss Planet Ant, a very unusual investigation of a leafcutter ant colony. Also, we'll have a roundup of this week's science news, including new evidence about the giant squid and the UK government's removal of climate change from the school curriculum. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. The Natural History Museum in London is home to one of the world's greatest preserved butterfly collections. But from March the 28th, the Sensational Butterfly Exhibition gives everyone a chance to see these majestic insects in something approximating a natural environment. On the grounds of the museum, a tent with subtropical temperatures has been taken over by thousands of butterflies and their native plants. I went to the museum to find out more about the new exhibition and their wonderful permanent collection.
Well, my name is Blanca Huertas. I'm the curator of the butterfly collection here in the Natural History Museum in London. As a curator, my role here is basically provide access to the hundreds of people who comes every year. So that's my first role. And also my role is to look after the collections because they're precious. They've been kept for more than 250 years, so I have to look after the drawers. We got about 35,000 of them, so we have to ensure there is no pest, there is no problems with humidity or something under control. So that's basically my role. And also developing the collections, because, as I say, it's an old collection. Taxonomy has changed, the world priorities, the research needs have changed. So I have to address some of those topics and do my own research also and use the collections. That's what I do.
And Blanca, we're here in the middle of, well, in the bowels of the Natural History Museum, surrounded by cases of butterflies. Is there something you'd like to show us?
Sure. Follow me, please. In order to take you to the collections, because there are so many specimens, I always need to look at in key numbers, so I need a kind of a map.
So we've got these beautiful, very modern cabinets, and yet inside you've still got the old drawers.
Yes.
They're the original ones?
Yeah, those are the original ones. We got a bit older drawers, of course, but the proper collection ones were acquired in early 1900s, 1905, something like that. So we could draw 100 years old and they look perfect because the museum has kept the ideal conditions in order to preserve not only the specimens but also the drawers where they are.
So I'm opening a drawer which is filled with rows upon rows of butterflies, and these ones are about the size of a 2p pence and they are small, blue, and they are pinned very tightly to these rows of white sticks. Yeah, so can you tell me about this butterfly? So this one's extinct.
Yes, this butterfly is extinct. It's a pretty one of blue cerces. It's called the cerces butterfly. It's called Glaucocica cerces. That's the Latin name. And this butterfly was extinct in 1944.
So how do you prove that a butterfly is extinct? And have you ever been on one of those expeditions?
To prove if a butterfly is extinct, that's the reason why museums are very important. The data we hold is basically a proof, and the specimens is a proof that butterflies were there. So basically we use that data to do maps and see where the species distribution was, and then send teams of people to search from the habit for that habitat if the species is there, and also if the habitat where the species was is still available. So that species we just saw, that's a proof that the habitat has been destroyed and also the butterfly has just gone lost.
And have you been on these kind of expeditions yourself?
I'm involved in the project of doing the red list of the butterflies of the tropics, because we got so many of them. We got 7,000 species only on the tropics. We don't have assessments of which is lost and which is not.
So how big is your net? How do you catch these species?
Well, I got about 3 or 4 different nets, because I always try to get the right thing. Butterflies sometimes don't like the white cloth, sometimes I like the black cloth, so I use both. And I got a short one when the butterfly is a species who fly very low on the ground. You need a tiny but a very strong net because they're usually fast flyers. But I also got something which is called a tropical net, which is 5 meters, 5 meters high. So that prevents me to go and climb the trees. So I use that one with the high flyers on the canopy.
I have this image of you jumping around the rainforest with this net that's twice your size. Is that what it's like?
Yes. Usually people who collect butterfly has to follow their butterfly habits. When it's very sunny, the butterflies get very active. Also, the researchers, the collectors, we have to be very active. So when it's dark and a little bit cold, we just sit down and have a cup of tea because butterflies are not around. So that's what we usually do.
So we've been looking at all sorts of preserved butterflies, and we're just about to go and see the live exhibit. But before we do, there is one species that's down here in the collection that I have to see before we go. So can you show me?
Sure.
Right down at the bottom.
Right down in this sandustru.
Wow.
Seems like a boring specimen among all of those fritillaries we got in here. That were in the corner that was collected by Charles Darwin himself.
Wow, so that tiny butterfly right at the bottom corner.
Yeah.
Collected by Darwin.
Yeah, that was collected in Chile. That's called Ramea citeris. And as I say, it's a fritillary among all of those, and we just found it a few years ago here in the collection. There are very, very few specimens of butterflies collected by Darwin, but this is one of the representatives we got.
I don't think they look that boring. I think they're rather beautiful, orange and black spotted ones. I think they're lovely.
Historically, people like big, bright, showy things, but interestingly enough, all of the tiny, brown, dull things are the most interesting among all of the butterflies we got in the collection.
I mean, that one we know is a rather special one.
Yeah, so. Very, very much.
Right, let's put it away. So we're going to go see now the live, giant, attractive butterflies for the public.
Absolutely.
That's more pleasant.
We've just walked into the live exhibit, this huge tent, and it's warm and humid in here, and there are butterflies flitting around all over the place, and it's like a mini rainforest in here. And Blanca, can you tell me a little bit about what the public can learn while they're here that they can't learn from the collections?
Basically, in the collections, you see only the adult stage. Here in the exhibition, we provide to the public the opportunity to see the different life stages of the butterflies and how they leave, how they emerge from the chrysalis, and how the caterpillars looks. Some butterflies are more adventurous and they lay eggs during the whole exhibition, so people have the opportunities to see that. What we got on display is basically the butterflies where the caterpillars feed on, and the flowers where the adults feeds on also. So people will see some associations between plants and butterflies that we don't have in the collection.
So right here in the middle of the room, there is a working lab, and in the shop window, so to speak, there's rail upon rail of pupas, and all different colours, is green and gold. And Blanca, can you tell me a little bit about what it's here for? Why is the lab here?
The idea is to provide to the public the experience of seeing the butterfly emerging from the pupas. We got all different species in here. As I say, we don't actually breed the butterflies itself. We bring the pupas to the museum, to the exhibition. Then we see on display basically the adults. And you see in the corner, the biggest pupas are from the moths, which are basically very close relatives to the butterfly. They belong to the same group. Butterflies and moths are virtually the same for us, for scientists, but for people it's different. So we got the different colors, as you say, shapes and sizes. And butterflies, also, they depends of the environment. They grow this skin outside them. The colors and the shapes and so on, it just depends of the habitat where each species lives.
Some of them have broken out from the working lab and they are flying around us. And just above our heads, there is a yellow and black one. Can you tell me what it is, Blanca?
That's a nymphalid, a brushfoot butterfly from South America that's distributed from Mexico to all of the Andean countries. It's called Cyproeta stellenes. It's a very common species, but still flies on the edges of the forest in the tropics.
And are many of the species here more common? Is that because they are easier to breed, or why is that?
Yeah, that's the reason. We have brought a sample from across the world. That's the other thing we offer to the visitors to see, not only European, because we don't have the conditions here, only tropical from the east and from South America also. So The species we bring here are basically common species because they're easy to breed, and the plants are not so specific, so they feed on different on plants that are easy to grow, basically.
Well, thank you very much, Blanca. It's going to be sad to leave this amazingly warm place. Finally, we've had a bit of summer, but it's been lovely to meet you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, and I invite everybody to come and visit the exhibition, which is going to be open until September.
As the lovely Blanca said, the butterfly garden at the Natural History Museum in London is open from March the 28th. For more information, just go to their informative website, nhm.ac.uk. Now it's that time in the pod when we take a look at some of this week's science and environment news. Joining me is Adam Vaughan, editor of environmentguardian.co.uk, and a newbie to the pod, Dr. Emily Sidoni Grossman, who is a science teacher and expert in cell biology and genetics, focusing on cancer research. Welcome to you both. First up, Adam, we are turning to a story that you've chosen. It seems that the UK's school system has decided to drop climate change. Tell us more.
So this week we have been reporting in the paper online that the climate change, the teaching of climate change on the geography national curriculum is being dropped, and there's been an outcry from everyone from former diplomats like John Ashton to former government science advisors like Sir David King, and also students as well, who are very unhappy that the sort of explicit teaching of climate change is going to be dropped. So it's been an interesting week. It's a story that's run, and there's been quite a backlash against it. There's been a petition against it, but there's been other people saying it's just a storm in a teacup and don't panic.
So by dropping explicit mention of climate change, what does that mean exactly?
So the detail of it is quite nuanced. Climate change has not been dropped completely from the national curriculum at all. It's been dropped specifically. References to climate change have been dropped from key stages 1, 2 and 3 for geography. However, and this is quite a big however, it will still be taught in chemistry. So if you have a look at the new draft curriculum, it's going to be in on earth sciences section of the curriculum for chemistry. But basically what it means is teachers are going to be left to decide whether to include, geography teachers specifically, are going to be left to decide whether to include it or not. Now, the new wording for the curriculum in geography does clearly give the leeway to teach about it, but as Ashton puts it quite articulately, I think it makes it legitimate to omit it as well. I think one of the interesting things is that the Geographical Association, the body that represents, 6,000 geography teachers up and down the country, doesn't seem to be bothered.
Neither does the Royal Geographical Society.
Neither does the RGS. So the sort of people you would... So, I mean, I suspect, in terms of the way this one play out, is going to be... I think they'll go, the guideline, the new draft will go through.
Emily, you're a teacher. What do you think about all this?
Well, I was speaking to some of my students yesterday, and what struck me is that 15-year-olds, which is the first time that climate change would have to be on the syllabus if this new law was passed, 15-year-olds are incredibly opinionated, incredibly articulate, and often have stronger views on things than perhaps myself or the adults around me. And I think to leave it to the age of 15 or 14, 15 to teach it is a real crime, because I think climate change is something that's so important. And by that point of their development, children have really formed their views on the world. And I actually spoke to one student who said, I can't imagine growing up to this age 15, and not knowing about climate change, because it just becomes embedded in their day-to-day life and becomes second nature, knowing that you should preferentially get public transport rather than use a car, or use less hot water than you need to, turn off the lights. She said that's become part of their daily life. And if she hadn't been taught it and hadn't known about it from an early age, she'd have thought, well, it can't be that important. It can't be that important to turn the lights off, or they'd have really told me about it at school.
So what do you think about the argument that children or young adults need to learn about the building blocks of geography before being able to understand something as complicated as climate change?
I think that's absolutely right. They do need to know about it, and they need to understand climate to understand climate change. But they can still be taught the importance of man's effect on the environment and the importance of what we need to do to combat that effect, and what we've done in the past that's been successful regarding CFCs or cutting down on cars, cutting down on coal. And they need to be taught, even if they don't understand exactly why, which they'll learn later, I think still to mention it and talk about it in an open debate and make it clear to them that it's not really opinion anymore. This is fact. This is you know, it's like evolution. It is becoming a real scientific fact, and to know about it is more important at that stage than necessarily to fully understand it at the same time.
I think the thing that seems a shame to me is certainly when you look at climate change from a sort of news perspective, it's not just a scientific issue. You know, it reaches across all areas of society. You know, it's politics, it's economics, it's technology.
Is there a worry that teachers may omit it completely?
Oh, well, that's exactly right, because it's left to the whim of the individual teacher. And, well, firstly, a lot of students don't do geography at GCSE, so it's up to the individual geography teacher up to that point to put it on their curriculum if they want to. And, for instance, a girl that I tutor, her geography teacher doesn't agree with climate change. So he doesn't actively tell them it's not true, but he leads a lot of debates and he opens up the topic of conversation. But I would imagine for teachers like that, if it were left to their discretion, they may not decide to teach it at all. And, okay, if that's something that's not scientifically credible, but given that what we know about climate change is that it is happening, it seems a shame to leave that to the discretion of the teacher.
All right, well, very interesting as that is, we're going to have to move on to the next story, which is about one of the legends, in my opinion, one of the legendary animals in the world, which is the giant squid. And a study has just been published that shows that from a possible 21 species of giant squid, there is actually only one, and that the animal has such a low genetic diversity that they are all of the individuals count as one very large global population. And I just find this fascinating, A, because it's a giant squid, and B, because it is gliding around the world and we know so little about it, and it just shows how little we really know about the oceans in general.
I was reading about this and I was fascinated by the fact that they, you know, can be so different and yet basically be the same species. But I did come away from it thinking, what does it mean? For example, for their, you know, survival in the future, you know, I mean at the end of what I've read on it, you know, there's great numbers of them already. So, I mean, do you have any sense of how this research, which, you know, seems like extremely involved, you know, the fact that they've had to go around and find samples of all the different squids they were looking at?
Well, I think firstly it resolves a bit of an argument, which is how many species are there to begin with? And more than giving an answer, it also shows how little we know, because, I mean, in terms of conservation, there might be loads of them, there might not be that many of them. To be perfectly honest, how on earth are you going to find that out right now? We're not able to. And I think this kind of study is interesting because it's taking the genetics, which is something that's not been looked at before. And it is important to know whether you have 8 different species or whether you just have one, because then if you only have one species and it's all over the world, perhaps that's less of a concern than if you have 21 species and one of them only lives in the waters around the Falklands.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of genetic diversity, if the one species that is present has pretty similar genetic makeup, then it's possible that an extinction would be possible if there was some change to their environment. So a low genetic diversity means that any small change to the environment would mean that either they all survived or none survived. And to me, that seems like a concern if we're looking at continuation of the species.
If they are all one species effectively, why are they all so different? Is it very much comes down to what the local marine environment is like in that, you know, off the coast of Japan or elsewhere?
I think it's definitely, obviously, a very important factor, but I think the honest answer is no one really knows much about the giant squid. And it's very interesting. It means the fact that they're so genetically identical means that it doesn't matter where they hatch. When they grow up as adults, it doesn't really matter that they've dispersed. You know, that something happens that makes them move, so it doesn't matter where they're born. And that is very interesting. It's interesting because we don't really know what makes them disperse. So whether they're roaming around as adults, tests already show that that's unlikely. They've done chemical studies of their beak, and it looks like they kind of stick to one patch of the oceans. So it kind of suggests that they spread from larvae, that the larvae float around and then they grow up from wherever they land. But we don't really know. And I just find it shocking, in my opinion, that we don't know something about an animal that's 15 meters long. And it's, you know, how many there are, we don't know. The range of them, we don't really know. How old they get, no idea. And I just think it's amazing that there's such an incredible animal floating around and we just know so little about it. Yesterday, for example, I was reading about another animal that's gliding around the deepest parts of the oceans that we also know nothing about. And I just find it extraordinary that there are these creatures that are, and considering, you know, modern science and all the things that we know and the work that we're doing in Mars and how little we know about our own planet. And it's called, the animal I was looking at, it's called the frilled shark. Have you ever heard of the frilled shark?
I have not.
Well, it looks the nearest to a sea serpent that you can get. It's got this blunt snout and these gills that are frilled. And it's got 300 little teeth, and each tooth has three spines sticking out of it. And it's just merrily going around the bottom of the sea, and nobody knows anything about it. And that is just one shark. You imagine how many others there are down there that we know so little about. And I just want to get on a submarine, to be perfectly honest.
Take pictures.
Yeah, definitely. All right, I think it's time to move on to the last story, Emily, which is yours.
Yes, so I've been looking at the story, which is the government considering whether to propose legal changes that would allow this so-called three-person embryo. So one in 6,000 children are born every year with a really serious mitochondrial disease, which can lead to neurological disorders, blindness, organ failure, and eventually death. And there's this new scientific treatment where they are proposing to be able to take the genetic information from the mother's egg and put it into a donor egg that actually comes from someone else. Now, that donor egg would be empty except for the mitochondria which contain the genetic information, which is damaged in the real mother. So it means that a very tiny proportion of the genetic information in the child would come from a so-called third parent. Now, I was speaking to Shamima Rahman, who's the consultant paediatrician at the UCL Institute of Child Health. And she said this idea of it being a three-person embryo is a totally crazy concept, because the amount of DNA that would actually come from this donor is so small that we should really see it as a tissue donor instead. But of course, there's been this huge amount of interest in this story as to whether the government should change the law to allow this to take place. So I thought it was an interesting topic to consider. I mean, what I think is important is that they've opened up the issue to public debate. So the HFEA, the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, have carried out a national consultation where they've asked people what they think of this idea as to whether the law should be changed. And of the people who expressed an opinion, over 60% said they were in favour of it. So to me, that seems like a go-ahead, and that in order to rid these children of this horrific disorder, which would mean that mothers who are carrying this disorder wouldn't be able to have their own children for fear of passing on this disease, then I think in the name of scientific progress that this is a fantastic idea. But there's been a huge backlash of saying it's a slippery slope and it could lead to designer babies and choosing the eye colour or the intelligence of your child in the future.
I mean, it sounds like a brilliant breakthrough. I mean, how far off are we from this in practice? I mean, you say that we're getting towards the sort of first legal hurdle here. It seems like the UK is leading on this.
Yeah, so I think it would make the UK the first country that was doing this, and the government have, I think, till the middle of April to decide whether or not to set about the changes that would change the law. And this practice is, I believe it's readily available at this stage, but it does need some more scientific research to disprove that it is fully safe. But it's really important that the government act now in order to set things in motion to move things forward, because if there's a block there, then they're not going to be able to do it.
Considering how little the genetic information from the donor would be, why do you think people are so uncomfortable with the idea?
Well, I think the main issue is that this genetic information, now you're right, there's only a tiny proportion, 37 genes come from the mitochondria, compared to 23,000 that come from the chromosome of the mother and from the father. So you're right, it's only a tiny proportion, but I think people's concern is that those genes will then be passed on to future generations. And there's a possibility, because scientists will never say never, because that's not our job, it's a possibility that those genes could in some way interact with the real mother or father's genes. But in my opinion, having spoken to Shamima, who she said those 37 genes in the mitochondria, they only code for proteins that are involved in powering the cell, in making energy. And so to me, it would seem almost impossible that they could have an effect on the characteristics of the child, the personality of the child. It's just not possible. But that's the concern, that you're affecting the child. It effectively had three parents, and then you're passing on that third parent's DNA to the offspring.
So given the three-person child or three-person embryo is a bit of a misnomer, what should we be calling this development?
I don't see it's any different to having a heart transplant and having a donor heart inside you.
And how far advanced is the actual technique? Because my understanding was that some of the sort of first successful tests on this have only been, you know, been happening in the last year or so in the US and elsewhere. I mean, how reliable and close are we?
I know that they've carried it out on animals and it's proven successful in animals. Obviously, they haven't done it in humans yet because they can't until they get the go-ahead. But they have perfected the technique of taking out the nucleus from the mother's egg, putting it into the donor egg, and then allowing fertilisation, or possibly doing it the other way around, fertilisation first. There's two ways of doing it. So they're, as far as I'm aware, at quite an advanced stage of the technique. So it's now just saying, can we actually try this in a human?
So if I was a prospective parent and I know I've got some sort of hereditary disease, what am I looking at, 10 years, more, less?
In terms of the technique?
Assuming that the UK green lights this from a legal standpoint, yeah.
Well, as far as I'm aware, the technology is now available. So they have to do more tests to check that it is fully safe. But I would imagine that this would be happening quite soon in a handful of people. And we're only really talking about a handful of families each year who have a very high level of defective mitochondria in the maternal line, in the mother line. So we'd only be talking about a few families each year, maybe 10 families each year, who otherwise wouldn't be able to have healthy children who weren't suffering from this terrible, horrific disease.
Who's opposed to it and why?
Well, public opinion is that about 40% of public opinion are opposed to it. It's anyone's guess as to why. I mean, the why is the sort of the ethics of, is this a slippery slope? Are we then opening up the doors to modifying the genes of our babies for future generations? Can we choose the characteristics of our children? Are we opening up this huge, big area of science where up till now it's been banned to meddle with the DNA of a child?
All right, well, that's all we've got time for. Thank you very much for joining me here.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Camilla.
Thanks to Adam Vaughan and to Dr. Emily Sidoni Grossman. To read Adam's writing on the environment, just go to environmentguardian.co.uk. And to learn more about Emily's work, visit her website, emilysidonigrossman.com. We'll have links on our blog.
It's fantastic to watch them work, because if you just looked at it, glanced at it, it would just seem to be random, but it clearly isn't.
I don't know if you can see up close, George, the way they're actually cutting the leaf fragments. It's really interesting. It's not how you might expect them to do it. They're not using those mandibles like scissors.
The right ant expert Adam Hart and naturalist George McGavin there in a clip from their film Planet Ant that is part of BBC4's Alien Nation season, looking at the wonder of insects. Planet Ant is a fascinating and novel look at a leafcutter ant colony taken from sunny Trinidad and reconstructed in a museum in Glasgow. Now, in case that sounds unusually cruel for a tropical insect, the colony was due to be destroyed for damaging crops. To find out more, I met up with George McGavin.
Well, this was quite a unique film because we transported a leaf cutter ant colony from the Caribbean to Glasgow, of all places, and we set it up. Now, the thing about these ants is they make spectacularly large colonies, but you don't see them because they're underground, and an underground nest can be the size of the room we're in just now, which is, you know, about 8 feet square, I suppose. And all you would see on the surface of the forest is trails of ants holding leaves going down underground, and that's it. So you can't really find out a lot about what's happening there. So our idea was to recreate an underground nest on a large scale and film every aspect of it, and that was quite a feat.
So how did you do that in Glasgow? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, Scotland doesn't have the same conditions as Trinidad.
No, it's a little bit colder and wetter. Well, what we had to do was to find a largish room and where we could have a colony and have the space around it. We then made a series of interconnected glass chambers, which is what they would have in the wild, in effect, that they would excavate hollows in the soil, and you'd have this massive interconnected system of holes in the ground, if you like. So we were able to recreate that in glass, if you like, in tubes, so that we could get right in among it. And then it had to be sort of dark, but not so dark that, you know, you couldn't film it. And it had to be, of course, warm as well. And we had to provide the animals with food. So the first question everybody asks is, oh, isn't it cruel, you know, transporting a leaf cutter ant colony from the Caribbean to England. Well, in fact, they, out there, they can be pests. And this particular colony was on an orange farm where they were just about to be destroyed anyway. So we went out there and got the Queen and a sizable proportion of their gardens.
So it was a bit of a rescue gardens. Effort, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, workers. And then we had to bring him to Glasgow, install them in their new home, wait long enough so that we were sure they were happy and growing, which they were, and then film.
How quickly did they settle in? I mean, how do you tell if an ant colony is happy?
If they're foraging and feeding and growing and producing young, then all is well. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty obvious early on that they were, you know, happy in their new home.
And how quickly did that take?
Only a few weeks I mean, it was only a few weeks before the ants were sort of settled in and obviously happy. And in fact, the fact that the whole of the colony grew in size massively over the 8 weeks or so of filming.
How many ants are we talking about?
It's hard to know exactly how many ants. I didn't count them all, but several millions, yeah. I mean, a large colony of these ants in the wild could be 8 million, 10 million or more, you know. So it's a sizable operation.
So why did you do this? Why are the ants so interesting?
Ants are one of the Earth's most amazing animals. I mean, if you take, in terms of biomass, I mean, if you were to add up all the ants in the world, they would equal the biomass of all the humans in the world. So they're absolutely huge volume of ants. There's about 12,000 species of ants. That's probably half what there actually is. You know, so we still have a bit to do finding out about all the ants. But it's what they do for the environment. Ants are one of the great ecosystem engineers. They are mainly carnivores, but obviously some, as the ones we had in Glasgow, are you know, fungivores. They don't eat the leaves. They grow fungus on the leaves and eat that. But if you think about a carnivore, I mean, if you were to say to anybody, right, think of a carnivore in Africa, everybody would say a lion. Exactly. Everybody would say lion. A carnivore anywhere else, you'd say tiger, whatever it is. But in fact, ants are the major carnivores on Earth, and they take away far more animal flesh than all other big carnivores added up. So whether it's your back garden or the savannas of Africa or the rainforests of Belize, ants are the major carnivores.
It's an interesting thought that I've not actually considered that before. So with this exhibit in Glasgow, you got unprecedented sort of access into the detail of their lives. Why were you doing this? What were you hoping to find?
I think I've always had a fascination for insects. I mean, as a kid growing up, I just loved animals, and that was it. And a degree was the obvious thing I would do in zoology. And it was in my second year that I realized that, in fact, all the big, you know, hairy stuff that everybody finds interesting normally, the vertebrates are actually rather dull. They're pretty boring, in fact. In fact, animals with a backbone only comprise about 2.9% of all species on Earth. I mean, that's trivial, actually. Insects alone comprise something like 66% of all animal species. So they're inherently interesting. And if you want to understand what's happening in the environment, if you want to understand the animal world and you don't know about insects, you don't know anything, in effect. And the fact that these ants, particular ants, have such hidden lives, all you see is foraging trails on the ground. You don't really know what's happening in the fungus gardens. You don't know how they rear their young. You don't know where the soldiers are, because every so often you find these massive soldier ants with huge jaws. Well, you know, we wanted to find out where they were in the, you know, are they all over the place underground, or are they in particular areas, or, you know, and all of this. And it was just a chance for the first time to gain this amazing insight into the private lives of these amazing animals.
So how did you do this? You said that you had cameras, but did you use other sensors or radio tracking?
We did. Because the ants are very interesting, and they're seemingly on the go all the time, but it's a very hierarchical system. You've got some ants are foragers, some are in the nest looking after young. Soldier ants, of course, are big, and they are there to protect the colony and the queen and the young, of course, from any threat. Now, because the soldier ants are quite large, we were actually able to physically glue a small tracker device on the back of about 100 of these soldier ants. We had hoped to do 300, but it was such an operation to glue these tiny little devices on the ants' backs.
And it doesn't affect the way they forage?
Nope. We were extremely careful about it, and no ant was harmed in the making of this film. On the tubes that join up all the parts of this great underground kingdom, we had small circular aerials on the tube, so we could tell which soldier was going along that tube in which direction, and we could then tell where they were spending their time and for how long. So that was a unique thing to do. And we found that the soldiers had a patrolling arrangement, so they would have a sort of circuit of four or five of these glass chambers, and they would, you know, a bit like a watchman. He would go here, then he'd go there, then he'd go there, and back to the beginning again. There was more of them around the Queen than anywhere else, as you would predict, but it's the first time it's been shown.
What about the other ants? Did you find out about the relationship?
Soldier ants are interesting because they're big and they're easy to do-ish. The other ants, of course, have various roles, and you've got sizes of foragers. So in the wild, it's actually particularly interesting because you've got these large foragers who are worker ants who are out there hacking off bits of leaf, bringing them back. And in the wild, you often see little tiny worker ants actually on the leaf load. So at first it was thought, that's a bit strange. Well, why should this worker ant carry her load, back to the nest with this other tiny little ant on top of she's carrying anyway? That seems not right. But in fact, there are flies out there who lay their eggs on the worker ants. And the job of the small workers, little tiny workers, is to sit on top of the load that the larger workers are carrying and protect them from these flies overhead. So they're actually fulfilling a really useful job. But then once those workers have brought the leaf material back to the nest, that's transferred onto slightly smaller workers whose job it is to chew it up into a paste, and then that's applied and taken down by other workers into the fungus gardens where it becomes the base for growing this particular fungus, which is only found in the leaf colony, ant colony. And that's what they actually eat.
And did you get a good look at these fungus gardens?
Oh yes, they are beautiful fungus gardens. I mean, they're amazing. I mean, it was a bit of a chance because, of course, you have a glass box and you can only hope that they make the fungus garden up against the glass so that you can actually see in it. We were quite fortunate in, I think we had about 40 of these, what is essentially a glass tank, all joined up, and we were able to see pretty much the whole process all the way down. And the other interesting thing, of course, is that ants are very tidy animals. You don't want your colony to be infected with any diseases. So when ants die, what happens to them? Well, you've got an option. You can either take them out and throw them away outside. That might be a risk because it may attract attention or other animals, you know. So what they do is they have a graveyard, which is right down below everything else. It's a long way down. And the ants who aren't able to forage anymore and haven't got, and often ants who are fairly elderly, get the job of taking any diseased ants or remains down into this graveyard. But yeah, no, I mean, it was a really fascinating way of actually seeing the inner workings of one of the most incredible social insects in the world. I mean, insects are basically the most efficient machines to reproduce themselves. They've got six legs, which is very efficient, and they can fly around, which is very efficient. They have the same organ systems that any animal has. They have a heart, a digestive system, a nervous system, etc. And these are animals that have been around on Earth for 400 million years. I mean, I predict, absolutely, if we find somewhere else out there in the cosmos that has an Earth-like place with an atmosphere and there are all organisms there, I'll bet you the first thing we will find, if it isn't a single-celled organism, will be something that looks remarkably insect-like, because it's the most efficient way of doing anything. I'm often asked by people, you know, what's the point of a fly? Yeah, what's the point of an ant? And I always reply by saying, well, what's the point of you? Yeah, what's the point of you? And the point of it all is to make more flies or more ants or more humans. That's it. You know, we're always hunting for a higher purpose, a higher thing. No, evolution is there. It makes more of us. And the more animals who make more of each other efficiently, and insects are par excellence the most efficient reproducers, and to see just how those insects work, how they actually operate on a small scale, was fascinating. They're also having a program about insect eating, which is of course a great thing close to my heart, insect eating. I've eaten insects for many years, and of course insect eating in the West, everybody goes, insect eating, it's horrible. But
I've never eaten an insect,
no. Well, you should, because we evolved as an insect eater, basically, and lots of animals. In fact, the majority of insects on Earth survive by eating insects. Without insects, we simply wouldn't have the majority of higher animals on Earth. So insects are a primary food for virtually all the birds, for instance. And there are lots of places in the world where insects are eaten, and they tend to be hot places, so Mexico, South Africa, Japan, Korea, China, where insects are large and abundant, and it makes sense to eat them because they're high in protein, they're high in fiber, they're low in fat, they're pretty healthy, actually. And the reason that we don't eat them in the West isn't because they're disgusting, which is often a reason offered. Oh, they're disgusting. No, no, no. The reason we don't eat them is it hasn't evolved here as a habit, because if you were to collect insects to eat and survive and feed your family, you would use more energy collecting those insects than you'd get back from eating them. So it just, you know, wouldn't work. But anywhere where insects are abundant and large, it makes sense, and it's evolved there, and that's where it exists. But you might be able to farm insects, and in fact, you know, as we increase to 8 billion humans, 9 billion humans, 10 billion, who knows? You know, you can't feed all those individuals on beef or fish, because virtually all of those will be gone. But insects are very efficient in the way that they produce their own flesh. And if you have a cow, you have to feed it 10 times as much food as the weight of the meat you get back. With insects, it's virtually 1 to 1.5 or something. So farming insects makes sense. You know, and we eat prawns. Come on. The insects are flying prawns, basically.
You've convinced me.
Yeah.
You've convinced me. I'm going to have to go out and buy a packet of insects.
A huge thanks to George McGavin, and Planet Ant will be available on iPlayer. But to find out about the other programmes in the season, go to bbc.co.uk/bbc4. That's all we have time for in this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Camilla Ruse, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.